Weaning is a stressful event for a young calf, moving from a monogastric system, almost a monogastric system, to a ruminant system where they don't consume milk anymore. They move towards concentrate and forage. The stressful period they experience can lead to increased disease states. Also, some that could be basically leading into mortality, higher mortality rate. So there's also, of course, concern about antimicrobial use and resulting antimicrobial resistance. So we have been for some time thinking about what methods we could use to help the animal grow better and be healthier going through this transition period.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Best Mix's industry-specific software supports feed and pet food producers in their daily challenges. Focus on your core job and let Best Mix do the rest.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast from North Carolina State University's Animal Food Manufacturing Program. I'm Adam Fahrenholz on behalf of Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today. Today, we have a little different situation in that we actually have two guests joining us, which is really exciting. Get to have some playoff back and forth. My two guests are Dr. Pedram Rezaman. He is the department head and professor in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Connecticut. And we also have Dr. Denise Konecki, who is an associate professor in the Animal Veterinary and Food Science Department at the University of Idaho. Dr. Rezaman and Dr. Konecki, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
So we'll go one at a time here, and Pedram, we'll start with you. If you wouldn't mind, you've done this podcast before, but if you wouldn't mind reminding the viewers a little bit of your background, and then since we talked last time, you're in a bit of a new position. So let us know kind of what you are up to now, and then we will move on to Denise.
First, thank you for having me. I did undergraduate and graduate studies in animal science and focusing on animal nutrition. Did postdoc training more focused on relation between nutrient metabolism and mammary gland health. That's where I started in a more general sense between nutrient metabolism and inflammation. I served at the University of Idaho for about 17 years and then went through the ranks, assistant associate food professor, teaching dairy nutrition courses and conducting research in nutrient metabolism and health area. Then I moved just a month ago or two to University of Connecticut, where I had done my PhD work as the new department head, and hopefully start teaching and conducting some research soon.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Denise.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I'm also a veterinarian. I did my undergrad and went to veterinary school at Washington State University, just across the state line here. And I have been in private practice for about 28 years and then had the opportunity to come to the university and start teaching and doing some research. So along with research, my teaching is basically animal disease related and reproduction and sheep science. And then you know, the research part of things, my area of interest obviously is animal health and also very applied research, things that we can, you know, take back to the producers and really help them to, you know, improve the animals' quality of lives as well as their, you know, production aspects. And then I also as well, you know, antimicrobial resistance and the effects that it has not only on the animals, but on the humans and the environment aspects of things. So
we've got two interesting experts on the podcast today. And what we're going to focus on primarily is some work that they had done collaboratively that focused a lot on calf nutrition and the idea of how to get calves properly weaned and some of the different things that go into that, different methods, different types of supplementation that can be done. So a little bit of a little less on the food manufacturing side of things and a little bit more on specifically what we are feeding different animals, and in this case, these calves. So I know that the project that you were working on, the two of you were working on, was looking at kind of just in general improving the growth performance and the health of calves through the weaning process. So if you wouldn't mind describing a little bit about, you know, what the problem is that you were looking at, and then the various different ideas of how that research progressed, that'd be great.
So the main challenge here is that, as we understood, weaning is a stressful event for a young calf. Moving from a monogastric system, almost a monogastric system, to a ruminant system where they don't consume milk anymore. They move towards concentrate and forage. The stressful period they experience can lead to increased disease states and also some that could be basically leading into mortality, higher mortality rate. So there's also, of course, concern about antimicrobial use and resulting antimicrobial resistance. So we have been for some time thinking about what methods we could use to help the animal grow better and be healthier going through this transition period over a relatively short amount of period. So we have been fortunate enough to be funded by several different agencies. We started with a project where that was USDA funded about 5 years ago, where we tested the idea of impact of weaning age and weaning pace on growth parameters as well as the health of the animals. So in those first series, we looked into how the pace of the weaning, whether it's gradual or abrupt, as well as how age, meaning an early age that we considered about 6 weeks of age or 8 weeks of age, could potentially interact with one another and impact those growth parameters, the health measures, and overall outcomes. So in an experiment we started with, we had bull calves divided into four groups, an early and abrupt, early and gradual, late and gradual, late and abrupt weaning methods were used. We measured, obviously, all the intakes, concentrate and forage intake throughout the period. We maintain a high plane of nutrition as far as the milk replacer goes. That's what the industry is moving towards, a high plane of nutrition, high protein and high fat content type of milk replacer. And on a weekly basis, some on a daily basis, we measured a lot of factors that we analyzed later on statistically. At the end of the experiment, we were able to obtain tissue samples and we did some gene expression work in the context of inflammatory responses that would allow us to basically link the pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory responses at the tissue level with the health outcomes that we were measuring on a live animals. So terminal sampling were quite challenging for all these animals, but thankfully we had Dr. Konecki there supervising all the procedures here. I'm not a veterinarian, so it was very important to have a team member with the veterinary background. So overall, I think what we have found out, and I'm not getting into any detail as of now, I will ask Dr. Konecki to add to my statements, but then we can go to the detail further if needed. Overall, what we have found on those first series of experiments were that The interaction was mostly affected by the pace of weaning and not the age. So it really didn't matter how early or how late we weaned the calves. It mostly had to do with how quickly we did it or how slowly we did go through the weaning process. So for the short one, what we call abrupt weaning, we went through some of the industry procedures that goes about 3 days. So you start the first day and second day is cut in half and third day is basically completed. As opposed to what we consider the gradual one, which we went through about 14 days. So we had seven steps down, step downs every time, reducing the milk replacer. This continued for 14 days. This was the very important finding in my view, because we had expected, especially on inflammatory responses, we had expected some major response from when we did the early age, and it just wasn't there. So to our surprise, and we had thought more interaction between age and the pace, which also wasn't very abundant, but pace was so strongly affecting all these variables that we were measuring. It was quite a surprise. I should also add to it that one of the major learning point for me personally was that calves have a very unique immune system. Just like their GI tract, which is quite unique and different from an adult animal, their immune system is also quite different than what you would expect from a cow, going through some type of environmental stress. In many cases, the response from young calves was quite different, and in several cases, completely unexpected. Yes, very, very unexpected results when it came to some of these pro and anti-inflammatory indices that we looked into. And we had many, many tissues. I'm going to ask Dr. Konecki to chime in now. How many tissues did we collect at the terminal sampling, if you recall?
Oh, well, let's see. We collected rumen sample, liver sample, two types of abdominal fat samples, then the duodenum samples, jejunum, ileum, colon, so however many that comes up to be, as well as in this recent, we also looked at, we collected some, you know, fecal samples for some microbiome studies, and then just digesta, so looking at the anterior or duodenal samples of digesta, and then also, you know, the fecal samples for some comparative work there. Muscle as well. We collected muscle samples.
I would imagine, a little less about the science itself, but more just from a practical standpoint. I would imagine we're not seeing versus what we might see in like the poultry or swine world. We're not seeing nearly as many terminal studies like that are done on larger species animals for many different reasons, the complexity and the cost and all other kinds of things. And so I would imagine when you were like going through that process, I wouldn't think you had a whole bunch of hands that were real experienced with collecting all of those kinds of different samples, right? I imagine you had a number of graduate students and whatnot that were really learning on the job of, okay, this is how we're going to do this. This is how we're going to do that. I imagine it was quite the learning experience for quite a few people.
Well, we do have, so we have a pretty active pre-veterinary group here in our department. And so one of the things they have to have is this experience, this hands-on experience. And so yes, it's an opportunity to get these individuals who think they want to be veterinarians actually in there and getting,
yeah,
Yeah, the real hands-on sort of stuff. And so there's opportunities there, as well as I work with the fourth-year veterinary students from Washington State University. So there's opportunity for them to be involved in some of this as well. And I will say that, yes, I mean, every animal that we have to terminate, we gather, you know, not only, you know, the stuff that we need for our experiments and things, but, you know, we have other labs for training students. And so, you know, we, you know, really utilize these animals to the fullest. So the benefit is that we are learning a lot from, you know, their termination. And I feel very good about that aspect of it.
Yeah, no, that's always, you know, like you said, it always does kind of make us feel better when we look at that idea of doing these studies, nutrition-based, health-based, whatever they are. And at some point, you know, we're going to need to collect digestive samples. We're going to need to collect organ samples. And there's really only one way to do that. But then the most that we can get out of it, and that includes not only, like you said, the samples that we're getting, but also the teaching and learning that we can get. You know, you've not opened this animal up before, then you should come do it now, because this is going to be an opportunity. I was going to ask too, a lot of times when we are doing nutrition-based studies, we are looking at folks that are primarily trained in nutrition, primarily trained in physiology. We don't always have veterinarian there on that team as well. So what's kind of that process like, I guess, in procedure of, or not procedure, perspective of being on a study like this, but actually having that veterinary expertise to bring to it versus more of just the physiological or the nutrition side?
I'm going to respond to it because I find it very, very blessing, simply because we form teams based on different expertise. Of course, when you make a plan of approaching a major question like we have in, as you know, cattle industry in general, whether it's dairy or beef, is a massive, massive importance in a state like Idaho. Mm-hmm. So our teams have been always multidisciplinary. That aspect is something that I'm very proud of. We've had nutritionists, we had physiologists, we had veterinary expert, we had economic type expertise on that. We have extension people, we have research, and in my humble opinion, most important, we've had the undergraduate as well as graduate students. So
sure,
these opportunities to work on terminal sampling do not come along easily or, mm-hmm. or inexpensively. So we capitalize to the best of our abilities. We capitalize on those opportunities. We would invite, this was something of very simple communication, but we would invite other labs just to show up and basically learn how things are done. The first sampling of duodenum and jejunum is something I like to bring up here for our undergraduate audience, might be of interest and a little bit funny. I ended up bringing a ruler. They could measure how many inches they were moving away from rumen to figure out where they are. Is this a duodenum or are we getting to the jejunum area? Same thing, moving from colon backward and see how far we go. So basically, like Dr. Konecki said, and you alluded to as well, excellent opportunities as far as having a veterinary expertise on the project, supervising all these activities. I think the educational value is, if not more, is as much as the research value of these collaborative projects. I've been blessed to have colleagues like Dr. Konecki for the past 10 years or so. So it's been real pleasure. as far as I can look at it. I'm sure Dr. Konechi will have some.
Yeah, now she has to say something nice about working with the nutritionist and the physiologist, though. And I'm over here being the feed miller guy going, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as a veterinarian, so the, you know, how the animals are doing and, you know, taking care of them, the day-to-day type thing is, I think, just having that expertise is important so that we keep these animals healthy and happy and through, you know, through the time that they are in the study, as well as, you know, keeping the individuals that are working and handling these animals healthy as well, because we do know that there are, you know, some things that can be transmitted between. And so, you know, the as part of their training, you know, the biosecurity aspects of things, you know, reducing any potential zoonotic transmissions, these kind of things. And I think I feel that's where I've been very helpful in being involved in some of these projects, as well as to just, you know, logistically setting them up, making sure that, you know, because we get these animals from farms, and, you know, we need to be able to assess that they are, you know, actually healthy, that we know that they've had good colostrum support and this type of thing. You know, but just being able to then, you know, again, assess these animals. And if there's any that are developing any kind of issue, that we can, you know, deal with it right away and then keep them healthy throughout the time that they're in the trial.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really interesting there and maybe in our few minutes left that to talk about is, well, one thing that was said about, you know, inviting other groups to come in and look when we're doing this kind of research. I really love that concept, right? Because it's, you know, I think it's probably too often that it's this lab, it's our project, we're doing it. And it's like, there's probably something that's going to happen, whether it be a simple weigh day or something much more complex, like you were like on your days of taking tissues, where others are going to be able to learn too. They can come help and they can come learn. And that's that, there's so much value in that instead of it being more kind of closed off and we're just in our own little silo. I think another thing that's really interesting that you touched on that I wish we could figure out a better way maybe to distill down and get even outside the university. Certainly there'd be a lot of people public facing, let's say, that the idea of doing some of this research and whatnot, just on their own thought, it's kind of like, well, I mean, you know, poor animals and all this other kind of stuff. And, you know, there's a certain amount of emotion that goes into it, and that's fine. But the idea of not only in the research situation, but also in the production situation of trying to distill down just how much all the people that are really involved in the work really do care about the animals and really do care about it being well. It's like, yes, this will be the end of it. But up until that time, these are going to be the most well taken care of animals you've ever seen in your life. And I'd really be great if we could get a little bit, figure out a way to tell that story a little better and get really people to understand animals don't give us good research data if they're not healthy, happy. We'll say happy, even though I don't necessarily know if I like the term happy, healthy, comfortable, well taken care of. Animals also don't give us any profit off meat, milk, or eggs if they're not healthy and well taken care of. It doesn't work that way. So I think something you just said there was very interesting. I don't know if either one of you have any perspectives on how do we tell that story better? Because I think in the research as well as in production, I think that's something we could do better as, you know, academia and in the industry as well.
I think that we need to focus a little bit more on what these days I think called the soft skills. When we train our undergraduate students and graduate students, we have to be aware that they need to learn how to communicate scientific context to the public. And I personally learned that much later in life than I should have. I think if we provide our students with more training on communication and leadership and basically interacting with public communities where they live, where they conduct experiments, and basically explaining it in a way that the public would have a good understanding of what happens when you conduct research, or even in, like you said, production setting. There are a lot of misinformation out there, and a big part of it, in my opinion, has to do with our lack of engaging the public in what we do in a true way, where they can actually see and draw conclusion for themselves, not necessarily wanting to interject any particular narrative. But once they see the animals that we use for research projects are taken care of the best way. And that, in my opinion, is an important aspect that public should know about. And they provide so much information that would help us to help them be healthier and be more productive and more, when you think about in the context of well-being, animal well-being in general, the standards for research protocols are always higher.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So we should learn a little bit more how to use also social media. I think I'm at fault, it's just like anybody else, by not doing enough on social media, just providing accurate information. There's so much misinformation out there, and there's so much that people would want to know about how their food is produced, where it's produced. And I think if we do a little bit more on engaging with the public and informing the public with facts, the misinformation at some point will be hopefully disappearing.
That would be nice. That would be nice. Dr. Kenichi, I would certainly welcome your comments from the same idea on the communication from the experimental side and things like that. But also, I imagine that you probably have some pretty interesting perspective on that from your time in private practice as well. I've spent a lot of my life around veterinarians, relatives, my wife now as well. And the idea of understanding that they're not only going to be working with the animals, but the animals don't talk to them. It's the people that do, and the amount of communication that they also need to learn, right? About, yeah, the hardest part of your job in many cases may not be the medicine. It may be this, it may be these conversations that you're having with your, not your patients, but your clients in that case. So I imagine from your perspective, you've seen a lot of areas where communication has become really, really important skill for folks to develop.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. I think that, one of the things I always, talk to undergrads about, as well as the students that are in vet school, is that, if you're in veterinary, if you want to be in vet school because you don't feel like you can, talk with people, you probably really need to think of another, profession, because somebody once told me, veterinary medicine is kind of like pediatric medicine. Your babies can't talk to you, so and neither can the animals. And so you're having to listen to their owners and then also explain, what you're seeing, back to the owners, and the communication is very, very important. And not only in the practice aspect of it, but just, as the students are developing themselves, the ability to learn and listen and identify with these animals, and be able to, kind of interpret what they're seeing. And I think, again, there's variations in how the students deal with or learn that, and then their ability to to express that. But yeah, communications is huge. And even within these research projects, there's no doubt the students that feel like it's going to be okay, and then the time comes when the termination occurs, and so they struggle with it. But the other thing I will also kind of touch on a little bit is at the time of the termination, because as a veterinarian, this is something you're going to be dealing with, is even though it's not pleasant, the euthanasia, which means good death, when we're, you know, taking care of these animals. And so this is another very important training aspect for these students is, you know, how we are doing this and then being able to, you know, assess and know that, you know, we've completed the job and then can move forward. So
it's time for our famous three.
Yeah, I think those are some excellent points, and it leads me into something I'd like to close here with. We know we have a number of folks that listen to the podcast, watch on YouTube, whatever, and that are, well, almost everybody's a part of some sort of a team, but we have quite a few that are part of teams that are focusing on research, whether they be graduate students that are working in labs or they be folks in the allied industry that are part of R&D. And I think kind of continuing this theme of communication, I'd love to hear your guys' perspectives on what have been the most effective ways of communicating and collaborating in that sort of a research team where, as many of us know, that are either in academia or in the industry and have advanced degrees and everything. We now have a lot of people in the room that are all quite intelligent, that all know quite a lot, have their own ideas of how things should be done and everything else. And then when you try to bring all that together as a team, there's going to be some push and pull on how things are going to be done, because at the end of the day, we're going to have to pick a method, a path forward, and there can be some disagreement on what the best is. So from your guys' perspective, you guys have, some of this calf weaning nutrition has been, you know, very successful. We've published on it, all these other kind of things that you guys have done that has been really, really beneficial, which required the team to come together and communicate. So what worked well when trying to do that within the context of the research you were doing?
I think what has worked well for us has been open communication. When we have new ideas, when we have thoughts on something, when we want to establish a new method, or we want to discuss a routine method where we feel like there's some challenges, when we face a new question, we sit down and talk. Open communication. We sit down and obviously civilized conversation is always productive. I think where I have failed in conducting research and facing the issues that you mentioned is where we have not had sufficient and open communication. So if we sit down and openly discuss options and go through some type of analysis where we can look at weaknesses and strengths and then come up with alternatives and carefully plan things. I think planning has been pretty effective for our team when we plan in advance and think through the steps that we want to take. That's been very, very effective. I'll be missed if I don't mention this. We've had excellent students involved, undergraduate and graduate and postdoc. We've had excellent students involved in our projects, and that makes a massive, massive difference in how things go. It's a win-win situation. Research is moving forward, and they learn a lot as we move forward generating new science.
Absolutely. Dr. Ganeshi, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we set up weekly meetings. We also understand that, you know, again, the different expertise that's in the room. And so when a problem is thrown out there, you know, as Padram said, we discuss it. But then oftentimes it's kind of like, well, we're going to defer to the expert in the room as long as that makes sense for, you know, everybody involved. And as I always, maybe sometimes people think I over-communicate, but that's my go-to is over-communicate instead of under-communicate. And I think that's really helped ward off some issues and you know, allowed us to be successful in what we're doing, successful and in a timely manner.
That's important. And you know, and I think you just touched on something else there as we close out. It's important that we communicate in a good way. But as you just pointed out, okay, maybe others might feel, or even sometimes you might feel that you over-communicate. But I think the longer that you do these things, you learn, this is my communication style. And if I don't communicate in my way, and I can learn to tweak things here and there when I need to, but if I don't communicate in my way, it's probably not going to work. I think it's very similar to teaching, right? Some people, they teach best behind the lectern, and some people teach best by wandering around the classroom. And if you're a wanderer and you think, no, professionally, I need to sit behind the lectern, that's not going to work. But if you prefer to sit behind the lectern and you watch someone wander and say the students really appreciate that, and you try to make yourself do that, that's not going to work either. And I think communication is the same. It's if this is the way that I communicate, and at this point I'm a pretty fully formed adult, as the point I'm going through, you know, doctorate degree and all this other kind of stuff, this is, you know, you got to become comfortable in this is who I am, this is how this is going to work. And I think that's also really important. All right. Well, I very much appreciate our conversation today. And we ended up breaking a little away from the science, which is fine. I think we kind of ended up making this a research communication in the context of calf nutrition kind of discussion. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fun, and I enjoy talking to other professionals that are in these areas about not just the what we've done, because we all get to talk about what we've done and write about what we've done all the time, but how we do it, I think, is something that. And it kind of came out in this conversation today. We all really enjoy talking about, and it's a little different than what we get to talk about on most opportunities. So again, my guests today have been Dr. Pedram Rezaman. He is the department head and professor in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Connecticut. And Denise Kanechi, she is a veterinarian and an associate professor in the Department of Animal Veterinary and Food Science at the University of Idaho. Dr. Pedram, Dr. Kanechi, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Again, my name is Adam Fahrenholz, on behalf of Wisenetics, and coming to you from North Carolina State University, this has been the Feed Science Podcast. Thanks very much for listening, and we will talk to you the next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.